Gentlemen, your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules. And at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. We got a really cool show for you tonight. Our guest is Steven Snyder, also known as Recluse. And he is the host of the wildly popular podcast, The Farm. And he's also the author of a new book. It's not so much new now, I guess. It came out back like in the fall. But it is titled The Art Book, The Secret History of Cywar, Conspiratainment, and the Shattering of Reality. And it's actually The Art Book 1. It's part of what is expected to be at least a trilogy of books from Steven. And I was just saying to him before we came on the air, it's just rich. It is richly packed with research into – I really couldn't even, like, do it justice, folks. But sort of like the occult – underpinnings of these various think tanks and how they're shaping reality and how they've been doing this, you know, since the end of World War II thereabouts. It's like these different groups came about with the goal of essentially shaping reality, shaping society, and how they then have left their fingerprints on all kinds of different cultures that you see throughout American history of the past, like 50, 60 years now. So I mean, that's sort of my basic thumbnail of the book. I really enjoyed it quite a bit. And Steven and I have crossed paths many times in the past. We're both sort of favored nations within the conspiranormal family and are frequent our guests at their annual Strange Realities Conference in Nashville. And so I had crossed paths with Steven many times in the past, but it kind of dawned on me here as the new year started and I was thinking about who should we get on Banal of America. It's like, you know, I never have really sat down with Recluse and talked to him and really kind of got into his head. I don't think we ever really kind of sat down at any point during the Nashville experiences and just kind of chatted it out and really connected. So not unlike Michael Hughes from the beginning of the year, I'm like, let's get Steven on the show and we'll sort of give him the Banal of America treatment and get to the bottom of his research and find out a little bit more about who he is and stuff. So, Steven Snyder, welcome to Banal of America, man. I'm really looking forward to finally getting the chance to chat with you.
Yeah, man, it's going to be pretty gnarly. Hopefully I can make up to you for eating all those edibles the last time we were hanging out. I still owe you a couple for that, man.
Right before we went into the Bellwitch game, no less. So it was...
Yeah.
It was... oh, man. Well, I was feeling it when we were in that cave. I was like, this is a bad idea, man. This is, I'm like, I don't know if I want to go in this fucking cave. This is a lot more cavey than I thought it was going to be, especially when we were going through those tunnels. Shit.
That was, it was pretty rugged too. I was actually like a bit surprised by that. You would think that the insurance claim for that place would have been like a little hefty, but I guess they were able to manage it. So who knows?
Well, you know, it was funny because when we went to go in, like when we went, you know, they ground you all up in the gift shop before they send you in, and they had, and it was like, oh, here, sign this waiver. And it's like, oh, okay, this is, you know, oh, this is part of the fun, right? Like, oh, I'm. In case I get cursed by the witch, I can't sue you kind of thing. But it's like a very real waiver. And it's like, if you die, you can't sue us. And I'm like, oh, shit. What's this all about? And then when we're on the outside, right before we go into the cave, the guy's like giving us all these fucking instructions and shit. And I'm just like, that's when the edible really kind of did a number on me. Because I'm like, oh, man, what have I gotten myself into here? This dude's like, he's not joking around. He's serious.
At least you remember the waiver. I don't even remember signing the frickin' waiver, man.
it was just paranoia upon paranoia. They just pounded you with it before you went into that cave. Yeah, the guy's like, if you think you're gonna fall, grab the wall. Otherwise, you can crack your skull open on the ground. I was like, holy shit, what have I done? What am I about to do? Oh man, yeah, that's a memory for a lifetime. So before we sort of get into the conversation, let's do the classic but all America, the bio, the background. Who is Steven Snyder? How did you get interested in all this stuff? As you heard, I tried to give a kind of really basic thumbnail of what the book is about. But your research is like parapolitics. It's like conspiracy theory. It's sort of the intelligence world. UFOs are in there. This sort of occulty, magical stuff. You really delve into a lot of different spheres of knowledge. So how did you get interested in all this stuff, and sort of take me a little bit on your journey here as a researcher?
Well, my dad was always really interested in conspiracy theories and that kind of thing. So, I mean, I sort of was brought up in that kind of household. I mean, I can remember actually listening to Bill Cooper with him when we were out vacationing in Colorado, like back in the mid-90s or something like that. That probably would have been around like 94, 95 or something.
Yeah.
So I always was sort of like surrounded a bit by that sort of subculture. Then getting into the knots I think it was 2002, if I remember correctly. I was living on campus at the University of Colorado Springs, which is not a great campus for psychedelic drugs, but nonetheless, I ended up doing some mushrooms when I was there. Had a really insane experience. It was, I think, about like midnight, and they had this, you know, cafeteria that was out there in the dorms. And they had it open in the middle of the night so kids could get kind of like a midnight snack or something like that. So I walk in there, and it suddenly looks like I've walked into kind of like an 80s music video. You know, there's like smoke and fog and stuff everywhere. And I see like these 7-foot-tall gray aliens walking amongst the students. I mean, they looked as real to me as you do right now to me on this camera. So it was really striking. And from that moment on, I had been really interested if people had had experiences seeing aliens in altered states of consciousness, and that had sort of started a lot of my research into arcane subjects. I think one of the first things I stumbled onto was like the experiments with DMT that Rick Strassman had done, where several of the participants had also reported seeing extraterrestrials, gray aliens in that case as well. And then I think from there I had stumbled onto the remote viewing experiments, because that was another sort of common entity that was reported in those states, were seeing these gray aliens. And once I started getting into the remote viewing stuff and also sort of more research into psychedelic drugs, that was when I stumbled into MKUltra and Artichoke and all this other stuff. And that kind of brought back, you know, some of the things that I can remember my dad talking about in my childhood. And from that point on, about 2005 or so, I did a tremendous amount of research. And then around 2010, I finally started to want to publish some of it. So that was when the Vizip blog started. Though ironically, Vizip was originally more of a ghost hunting outfit. It actually stands for Volusia Investigative Society of Unexplained Phenomena. So that was my kind of original foray into this ghost hunting.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Parapolitical
musings on the side. Had some pretty gnarly experiences in Casadega, Florida, which is a crazy place, and kind of ensure that I would have a lifelong fascination with the paranormal. So anyway, I did that. I did the blog for about 10 years, and that was when I finally started to get into podcasting around 2019. Also around the time I published my first book, which I co-authored with Frank Zero, and then subsequently I've done 2 books since then and have continued on with the podcast. I wasn't aware it was widely popular, actually. That's cool. But
yeah, for sure. It is. I think it is. Yeah. The Farm. Yeah. Well, you do a lot of traveling. I'm completely blown away by how much traveling you do. You really crisscross the country sort of checking out a lot of these interesting arcane sites.
Yeah, and it's funny because I was a homebody for a long time, too. I hadn't really done any significant traveling, actually, since probably around 2005 or something like that. It kind of just started by accident when I made plans to go out to Somerset, Kentucky to see the Pennyroyal guys out there around 2020, I think. And then from there, I just kind of got more and more into it. And the more places I went to, it just kind of became evident to me that, you know, you can do all the research or something on a place, but until you've actually been there and sort of stood in the location and seen everything, yes, it's hard to truly grasp the significance of it. So as time went on, I became a lot more obsessed with in the field research and actually exploring a lot of the sites and places that I was interested in writing about. And I definitely think that that's helped tremendously.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think I was marveling about that with somebody on the show recently, where it was like, a bunch of us went to Point Pleasant, and it was like, I was standing like where they saw the Mothman the first time, and it's like, okay, now you can really take in the whole milieu or whatever, you know, you can get the whole sense of what it must have been like to see this thing on the road late at night or whatever, because you're on the road. You're very on the road where they saw it. It's like, okay, I can totally kind of get the vibe of what these people experience.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I'm, you know, kind of an ongoing process of going around the country and trying to find, you know, these things that I kind of think of as roadside attractions in the Neil Gaiman sense or Gaiman sense from American Gods. These, I don't know, just these spots that seem a little too weird and a little too cool to exist in real life, but somehow they do. Yeah, and yeah. I find that there's often a kind of magical property to a lot of these spots or festivals, things of that nature.
Yeah, yeah. So the book, as I said, it's The Secret History of Psywar, Conspiratainment, and the Shattering of Reality. One of the things I wanted to ask you, I want to make sure I don't forget this. This is a completely sort of off-the-wall aesthetic question, but what made you choose the size of this book, dude? It's like a coffee table. It's like coffee table size.
I didn't choose the size of it. That the guy that I hired to do the formatting just sort of sent it to me with that size, and at first I was just like, oh man, I can't really do this. But then the more when I looked at it, I was like, especially with that cover, I mean, it does sort of have almost like that graphic novel kind of like aesthetic to the cover with it. And the more I thought about it, I was like, you know, this actually, it kind of works for this book in some ways. I mean, I also think with like all of the footnotes and stuff that I do, which are on the same page with the text, right, it sort of helps as well. So not everything is not all like kind of clustered together in small print.
Yeah. Well, and I mean this as a compliment. It reminded me a little bit of the Bill Cooper book, because the Bill Cooper book is like oversized.
Yeah.
So I thought maybe it might have been like an homage or something like that. But yeah, it's cool. It's different. I don't know how I'm going to fit it into my bookshelf now that I've done the show, but we'll figure that out down the line. So I gave sort of a thumbnail on this book. Can you sort of pick up the baton where I might have dropped it there? How would you classify what's going down in this book?
Well, it was an evolving process in writing it. I had started it, I think, back around like late 2020, and it was essentially going to follow the genesis of the QAnon movement. Yeah. And the more I started looking into this, I started realizing it was, you know, not going to be a simple topic. I was going to have to explore the history of psychological warfare. I was going to have to go back and start exploring a lot of occult traditions with like Rosicrucianism and things like that. I was going to have to start looking into the Fortean Society, just a whole slew of subjects that I thought were necessary to cover to make the thing work. So I kept plugging away at it, and then I think when I had gotten up to almost 200,000 words, I was like, yeah, this is not going to work as one book. So at that point, I was in a bit of a crisis for about a year as I was struggling to figure out, like, how exactly to divide it up. And then I finally, you know, it finally became clear to me, I want to say like maybe around March, April or something like that, 2023, like, okay, this is how it can finally work out. Right. So that basically led to a final reorganization of trying to put as much of like the parapolitical stuff in the first book as possible, mm-hmm, so that the second book would sort of be cleared to go into some of the more archaic, you know, metaphysical, occulty kind of subjects. But anyway, this ended up being an exploration, the first book, that is to say, an exploration of the development of psychological warfare throughout the process of the Cold War and going into current times. And as I was working on it, I kind of have this tendency, I guess a bit like Jason Horsley does, where when I'm working on a book, I need to find somebody who's like the protagonist of it, you know? So
yeah.
As I made the decision to turn it into one book or three books, with the first one focusing on psychological warfare, it kind of became the question of, well, who's the protagonist in this story that I'm trying to tell in this book? It became pretty obvious that it was Edward Lansdale. Originally, I think I was going to write about Lansdale for like maybe two or three pages, you know, like a couple of paragraphs or something. And then as I just kept looking at this guy, more and more stuff came out. And the Lansdale.
Yeah, he gets like the star treatment in there. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it kept growing and growing. And finally, I was like, well, gosh, if I'm going to do this justice, I'm going to have to fly out to California and go to Hoover Institute so I can look at this guy's papers and really start digging in there. So it became quite an obsession fleshing out a lot of parts of this guy's life. But I thought that was ultimately something that really gave the book a unique perspective, because Lansdale is just a figure. You see him mentioned a lot, but I don't think that anybody's ever really grasped the sheer significance that he had to the national security state during the Cold War, because he's usually depicted as sort of this, you know, buffoonish figure. I mean, everybody thinks of it with the whole illumination by elimination thing, where he was proposing that they were going to project an image of Jesus Christ over Cuba in the aftermath of the Bay of Pigs debacle, and that was going to convince the Cubans to overthrow Castro because Jesus had come down and told them that he was an instrument of godless communism or something like that.
Yeah.
And there was a lot more to Lansdale than just that, to put it mildly.
Yeah, well, you have some interesting anecdotes, like in the book, where it's what kind of blew me away reading about. Yeah, he at one point, you say he kind of orchestrated a lot of psychological operations where he kind of like would mess with the enemies, thinking that like there was a their cultural supernatural sort of ideas. He would like turn them against them to mess with them.
Yeah, I mean, he really developed the whole concept of effectively weaponizing a society's mythology and even their spirituality and religion to use against them. And this was very quote-unquote scientific, or at least as scientific as you can get with these kinds of things. One of the guys that he worked very closely with was Charles Bohannon, I believe his name was, who had actually been a Harvard-trained anthropologist prior to the Second World War. He had worked with the Smithsonian. And in the aftermath, when he and Lansdale ended up in the Philippines, it was Bohannon who Lansdale really leaned on quite extensively to analyze the indigenous culture there and define tropes that they could use against them for the psychological operations that he had been considering. And in Lansdale's sort of parlance, this would include what he referred to as quote-unquote low humor. And sort of the famous example of that is he had several insurgents rounded up. He had them killed. He had their bodies drained of blood and had puncture wounds put in the necks. And then he hung them from trees so that other bands of insurgents would find them and believe that they had been killed by vampires, yeah, which he thought was quite humorous, though I would imagine the people who found the bodies didn't necessarily find the humor in that. But this was a series of different methods that he had used there. I mean, another one was to have these sort of Masonic eyes painted on the doors of suspected insurgents. They would record confessions of insurgents that they had made before they were executed, and then he would have planes go over villages and play back the confessions and recordings from speakers so that they would think that, you know, they were being haunted by the ghost of this insurgent who had been dispatched of. So there was a lot of this kind of stuff playing into his approach to psychological warfare. And this was effectively enshrined in the policy guidelines for psychological warfare for the U.S. Army going forward, which was something that I found to be quite remarkable. But when you look at something like, Operation Wandering Souls, that's somewhat known in conspiracy circles because Michael Aquino had worked on that during Vietnam. But it was essentially the same principle of what Lansbow had been doing with the Philippines, where now you're using helicopters to go by with loudspeakers and it's playing out the voices of these Viet Cong that have been killed. And you're trying to convince the countryside that they're being haunted by the spirits of the departed.
Yes.
So this had become really prolific within the military by the time the Vietnam era had broken out. And this is especially true in terms of sort of the broader use of counterinsurgency that the United States had embarked on during the Cold War. And that was another thing about Lansdowne, the Philippines, that was so important that I found out, because this was basically the laboratory where we developed all of this stuff. I mean, almost every American counterinsurgency effort during the Cold War was based off of things that Lansdowne was doing. Mm-hmm. And it included this colorful, let us just say, approach to psychological warfare. And it also involved the use of a lot of commando teams, hunter killers, as they were dubbed at times. And this really laid the foundation for sort of the culture of special operations forces that's now become so prolific. Lansdowne, again, one of the things that I found out, he was one of the major visionaries behind what we would now think of as the Special Operations Command and the Joint Special Operations Command. So that whole culture really grew out of initiatives that Lansdowne had begun when he was in the Philippines. And then later, this stuff was brought to Vietnam. It eventually grew into the Phoenix program. And as time went on, it really spread across the whole of the globe where the United States was involved in counterinsurgency efforts or where our vassals were engaged in it. I mean, you can see sort of traces of this approach in something like Operation Condor, which was run across the southern cone of South America during the 70s and 80s. So it was a very significant development in national security policy, to put it mildly.
Yeah. It's fascinating because it makes perfect sense, but then it's just like you're amazed. I was amazed that this guy came up with it like in the army where it's like, let's just try and we'll play the ghost sounds, like you say, the vampire stuff. It's like, it's just wild, wild approach. And then that makes me think sort of, you kind of asked the question in the book, like, did this get turned back around on American society? And it's just like, part of me, I've grown more skeptical of like the idea of aliens and everything and more cynical about the whole subject in a lot of ways. Your book in a lot of ways kind of reinforces that in a sense where it's just like, part of me just thinks a lot of this UFO stuff is just government hinkery. Like they're using it to cover for all kinds of stuff. And that certainly, you know, makes me wonder, especially about the more golden age of ufology type era stuff, where it's like, okay, what was really going on? What secret hand was sort of amplifying this stuff?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, again, it begs the question, if we were willing to do this to other cultures, would we stop there, or would we not be willing to do it domestically?
Right.
Which I think the answer to that would be a resounding yes. So when you start looking into what is the mythos of America going into the second half of the 20th century, UFOs had very much become a major component of that. And incidentally, too, though, it was also sort of a dual purpose, because this stuff was really becoming big in the Soviet Union as well. In fact, that was one of the things that I was really surprised by to learn when I was working on this book. But the Russians had actually embraced the whole concept of ancient astronauts going back to like the late 50s, early 1960s. Mm-hmm. And they had briefly toyed with really making it a major component of Soviet ideology, because this provided them with an explanation for, you know, miracles that were attributed to Jesus or other supernatural figures in the past and whatnot. Well, you know, they were actually all just aliens and this kind of thing. Yeah. So that was sort of another factor where I think U.S. Psychological warfare officers were also using the UFO narrative to both attack Soviet intellectuals as well as managing the perceptions of the American public as a whole. So it's another really interesting component to it, and why you can sort of see the ufology has been so obsessed over by the national security state from practically the beginning, and not even, you know, really related to the discovery of some kind of extraterrestrial biological entity or something like that.
Yeah. Well, it's when you really take a step back from it, like kind of what you do in the book, and you look at just the UFO phenomenon, it's like, look, all this shit's been going on for years. There's no actual, like, we haven't actually seen any aliens or anything. So it's like, you know, you got to kind of take a second look at it and wonder, like, okay, maybe there's something else going on here that fucking doesn't have anything to do with. Now, look, there may be some aliens coming here, folks. Don't get me wrong. But, like, there's a lot of UFO lore out there. And it's like, this is kind of hinky. This is kind of strange. You make a point. You talk about the aviary in the book. And I thought it was interesting. You sort of trace some of the members of the aviary back to SRI. You sort of, you note that, like, SRI seems to be the nexus of all this UFO lore that sprung out of the aviary, which is like part of now the fabric of ufology today. It's remarkable that people, you get the people who come in like since the New York Times article, like in the last, now I think it's like 7 years or whatever. It's like they, to them, it's like MJ-12 and Roswell and the Dulce base. This is just part of sort of their weird history. And it's like, no, there's way more to this stuff than you guys know about. Like, we know where we can trace these stories back to, like, how they came up into the ether. And it's like, there's, again, a hidden hand here behind these things that makes you do a double take and wonder, like, maybe this has nothing to fucking do with aliens at all.
Well, certainly, I mean, that's a way that you could look at it. But, I mean, I almost feel like when you really get down to it, it's even weirder than what the public at large has been led to believe, because I don't know that you can necessarily reduce all of, reported or suspected extraterrestrial phenomena to simply being psychological warfare.
Right, right.
But it's also not, I think, something as easy as just, well, the extraterrestrial biological entity came here in a nuts and bolts spacecraft and touched down. I think that the situation is much stranger than that. And that really goes
back to
the foundation of this sort of research. When you look at things that were going on with the Psychological Strategy Board back in the late 40s, early 1950s. And this is a body within the National Security Council that was tasked with handling covert operations. It's going through numerous name changes over the years. It was the Office of Policy Coordination under Eisenhower. It was like the 40 Committee. It was the Special Group under Kennedy. It was the 40 Committee, I think, under Reagan. God knows what it's called now. But anyway,
This
thing was designed to coordinate all of the sort of covert operations that we're doing, the psychological warfare operations, et cetera, et cetera. And it was also looking at the extraterrestrial question. But it was also monitoring a lot of the research that was being done under the auspices of Bluebird, which became Artichoke, and then the other program related to all of this, which was MKUltra.
Right.
And this is the thing that's really fascinating about this, because a lot of this psychological stuff really does go back not to SRI, but to MKUltra and Artichoke. Because this, again, also where you get the formal interest in the national security state on their part in ESP and parapsychology and this kind of stuff as well. You know, you can look at a guy like Adrina Puharik, who was almost sort of the figure bringing a lot of this research into the national security state. And he was approached originally by psychological warfare people. That was really what his interviews were for when he was brought into the Army, and he was reporting to the Psychological Strategy Board ultimately. So this is where you get into the notion of this being really woo-woo, where you have to wonder to some extent, why is it that you have guys like H. Marshall Chadwell, who have briefly headed Project Artichoke, who also ended up in the Robertson Committee, who was obsessed with the UFO phenomena and trying to understand it? Were these things exclusive, his work on Artichoke and his interest in ufology, or was there something that connected all of these? And this is where I really have to believe that in doing a lot of the experimentations with psychedelics and things like that, that they became convinced that there was a reality to the phenomenon.
But yeah, yeah.
Was much more closely related to consciousness than anything necessarily physical.
Right, right.
And that was potentially the real secret to a lot of this that they were trying to obscure from the public. So you have to kind of wonder in some extent if the perception that we've been given about UFOs, that they were these nuts and bolts spacecrafts that came from Zeta Reticulum or something like that, and they needed, I don't know, our pineal glands or something like that to continue on with the species. If these were basically narratives that were being put out to obstruct the fact that the phenomenon was much stranger, and then also, I mean, potentially soothe the American public, I guess you could say, because again, if this stuff is really related to consciousness, if it plays into things like the multi-world hypothesis or something like that, well, it's a lot more complicated than just, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 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 for sure. No, I get exactly what you're saying. Yeah, yeah, it's like, yeah, the alien idea may not be all it's cracked up to be, but the idea that there's something happening here is, I think, you know, it seems pretty certain. And the fact that these people kind of got so bought into it makes you they had to believe it too. So that, yeah, it's an interesting perspective in a way. And yeah, it makes me wonder a lot about, yeah, they must have known something that, like, or come upon something that made them really invest in this stuff in a way that, and like you said, want to keep it kind of under the radar of the American people. So they're like, oh, just let them think that it's aliens and shit, because that's a little easier to digest rather than, you know, we're existing within in the same sphere as some kind of other that's much easier to interact with, provide under the right circumstances, some of which we may not even be able to control, kind of thing.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think this is also why you sort of see this thread of ESP that sort of continues through all of this as well. Again, going back to Puharik's research with Artichoke, with these other groups during the 1950s, continuing on with SRI. And then also, you know, sort of concurrent with that too, a lot of the research that was being done on what we would think of now as like non-lethal weapons or psychotronic weapons and things of that nature. And again, this is also essentially developing along much the same lines with the Soviet Union. The Soviets always saw ESP research and psychotronic research is being closely related. We've tried to cover that up as far as I can tell here in the United States, but again, when you look at some of the people tied in with SRI, like I think it was Russell Targ, for instance.
Yeah.
So what was he doing before he got into investigating parapsychology? Well, he was working on developing lasers. And again, lasers, I mean, this plays into theoretical ways of which microwave weapons would be used. When you look at other people like Colonel John Alexander, who became a big part of you know, some of the Army's forays into ESP, I mean, his day job was also looking into non-lethal weapons. So, again, it raises, and then obviously I'd be remiss with not pointing out Kirkland Air Force Base for that matter. I mean, this is another area, you know, again, this is sort of the Benowitz affair. This is really beginning of what we would sort of formally think of as the aviary. But again, Kirkland Air Force Base also did a lot of research on microwave weapons. It was where they did a lot of testing with this. So it's just a thread that runs through all of this. And again, that's where I kind of go back to the notion that consciousness was integral to the phenomenon. And that, in a sense, sort of seems to have been the purpose of a lot of these different programs, where it seems like a lot of this stuff isn't related, but when you really get down to it, the attempts at mind control, at brainwashing, potentially stuff related to UFOs, things related to psychotronic weapons and ESP, all of this essentially boils down to different states of consciousness, what consciousness can be used for, and all this other kind of stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, now, wouldn't you, I hate to drop a name on you here, but it blew me away that you came up in the book, Cleve Baxter, because I always just thought of Cleve Baxter as the guy who hooked up the plants to the lie detector machine or whatever, and like kind of came to the conclusion that there was some kind of consciousness within plants. But that's all I ever kind of thought of. I thought he was just sort of an eccentric guy who came up with this thing. But then in the book, I discover that, like, he had quite, he was kind of mixed up with a lot of this stuff. He was, these characters and things. He may have been in the aviary. I think he advised at SRI or something like that. You detail it in the book. I didn't want to completely throw that a curveball at you, but I was just like, holy shit, Cleve Baxter. The plant guy.
No, he's one of the most insane people that I've like followed through a lot of this because, okay, so first off, Cleve Baxter was OG Project Bluebird. He was one of the first guys in the committee over that. And I, you know, he was another guy I tracked down his personal papers for. I think they're at a university in Georgia right now. I can't remember which one. But his big thing was narco-hypnosis. That was what he did when he was in the Army. He had a very specific program for this, and it was later incorporated pretty heavily into Project Artichoke. And I don't know if the quote-unquote artichoke treatment was based on some of Clive's work, but there's a strong possibility of that. And the artichoke treatment, for those of you unfamiliar, this was a form of interrogation that they developed where essentially they had this cocktail that was known as Smasher, I think. It was a combination of LSD and metoprolol or something like that. It was this drug that basically sent you into uncontrollable convulsions. Okay, oh, so Jesus. You're being given an heroic dose of LSD combined with this drug that makes you go into convulsions uncontrollably. Mm-hmm. You're strapped down into a chair while you're going through all of this. And if that wasn't enough, they would also start administering electroshock treatment.
Oh, my God. Who are they doing this to?
They did this to all kinds of people. They did them to POWs, to military men. They did it to people in prisons. One of the big issues the artichoke had in the early days, what they referred to as the disposal problem. What do you do with these people after we've subjected them to this, essentially?
Yeah, that's an issue, yeah.
So Cleve was tied up in all of that. By the 1960s, he became involved with an infinitely fascinating group called the Sovereign Order of St. John of Jerusalem. So this is a military order that claims to be the true successor to the Knights of Malta, not the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, which is the quote-unquote official Knights of Malta.
Okay.
This goes back to the loss of Malta during the Napoleonic Wars at the end of the 18th century. So briefly, the Knights of Malta relocated to St. Petersburg, and they were briefly given patronage by the Tsar. After Peter died, though, the patronage was withdrawn, and the order, as history records it, relocated back to Rome, and that's where they became the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. So the Order of St. John insists that they are the remnants of the St. Petersburg Knights of Malta, that they continue to exist in Russia, and then they emigrated over to the United States, and they waited covertly until the 1950s, in which they finally would reemerge before the public. The guy who headed this outfit for many years as the chancellor was a guy called Charles Pichel. He was an infinitely colorful figure. He was, I believe, convicted of drug trafficking during the 1920s, which he claimed were for medical purposes. He essentially ran a kind of quasi-methadone clinic, except he actually used heroin instead of methadone. But he would give his, you know, his patients like slower and smaller dosages, so he would gradually wean them off of it.
All right, yeah.
He also ended up collaborating with the Nazis during World War II, lots of other wonderful stuff. So anyway, he ends up founding the Order of St. John in the mid-1950s, and by the late 50s, early 60s, it's got all of these senior military officers involved with it. You go through, like, their military affairs committee, it's General this, Admiral that, Colonel so-and-so, all senior military officers. One of them was General Charles Willoughby, who was MacArthur's spy master. In this capacity, he effectively ran all U.S. intelligence in the Pacific theater around Japan from throughout World War II and pretty much up to the time that MacArthur was sacked in Korea. You had General Bonner Fellers, who oversaw all of MacArthur's psychological warfare efforts. You had people like Admiral Charles Cook, who was a big guy in the Navy at one point. And among these characters, you also had Cleve Baxter. You had another guy that I know you're familiar with, too. His name is Colonel Philip Corso.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
The guy who wrote The Day After Roswell.
Right.
So, anyway, as to the Order of St. John, really fascinating group for several reasons. One of them is because it has been deeply implicated in acts of right-wing terrorism for years. From pretty much the beginning, they were closely tied to proponents of what is known as Christian identity theology. If you're not familiar with this, it's a sort of form of British Israelism that holds that white people are the true Jews of the Bible, that non-white people are essentially subhuman mud creatures or something to that effect, and that the actual Jews are demonic entities that have been sent to earth by Satan to torment us ad nauseam. So anyway, this theology has produced a lot of terrorists over the years. One of the big figures behind it was another ex-military guy, William Potter Gale. Gale had acknowledged that when he started preaching identity and setting up the various militias he was connected to over the years, that he had been told to do this by Colonel Benjamin von Stahl and General Pedro Del Valle, both of whom were members of the Order of St. John. Del Valle was also a backer of George Lincoln Rockwell, the founder of the American Nazi Party. He contributed money to his efforts, all this other stuff. So anyway, throughout the 70s and 80s, they were closely tied to these people. Throughout this time period, the Order of St. John would go through several schisms. So you had other variations of it that went into even more extreme circles. By the late 1980s, early 1990s, one of the branches of this, the John Grady branch of the Order of St. John, was implicated in the FBI's PatCon investigation. This is the same investigation where they stumbled on Timothy McVeigh and all this arms trafficking that these militia groups and what have you were doing. So you have Charles Pichel, the Chancellor of the Order of St. John, who on the one hand is sitting here corresponding with all of these proponents of Christian identity, theology, and all this other stuff. And then you have Cleve Baxter, who's going around the country, who's interviewing people like Travis Walton about their abduction experiences, and who's sending all of these reports back to Charles Pichel. Pichel, when he's not contemplating how white people are the true Jews of the Bible, was a big proponent of orgone energy, for instance. The Order of St. John actually issued a memorandum that Cleve Baxter kept that asserted that orgone energy was the true alternative energy source, and that the Order of St. John's purpose was to bring about a glorious utopia which man would embrace orgone energy, do away with nuclear energy and fossil fuels, and establish a one-world theocracy, which would be headed by the Order of St. John to destroy the demonic, satanic forces of communism or something.
Jesus, this is quite the organization.
Yeah, yeah. This is probably the most batshit, like, ideology I've ever encountered in my life.
Yeah. I'm in awe here. I'm agog right now listening to what the fuck?
Yeah, so
like this is to put over Stephen's book. Yeah, this is kind of like it's kind of a little unsettling in a way, the book, because just kind of it introduces you to a lot of like organizations and groups and think tanks and sort of secret societies that have kind of been operating behind the scenes that most people haven't ever heard of before. And it's like, oh shit, this is unsettling that this shit's been going on, that there are these groups, that there are these people with these ideologies, and they're high powered people, and they're like fucking mixed up with the intelligence services. It's like I said, it's a bit unsettling sometimes.
Yeah, to put it mildly. But yeah, the stuff with Baxter just looking into the Order of St. John, I mean, it was just so insane. And that was something that the more I looked into it, it was just because I had, you know, realized that there were connections to sort of the UFO and the New Age circles within the SOSJ. But the more I looked at that, it became kind of disturbing, especially in light of, you know, what we're seeing essentially now in the post-QAnon world, where you're seeing more and more people within these sort of New Age and UFO-centric circles really being targeted by the alt-right. But yeah. I think you can sort of see how this process had begun all the way back during the Cold War, where there were these efforts to try and infiltrate a lot of these far-right elements, many of them connected to the military, for that matter, within into UFO circles and New Age circles and this kind of thing. And now it's become quite a cesspool, to put it mildly, going into the 21st century.
Yeah, what left me shook up in a way too from the book was just like contemplating, okay, you can see what these people were thinking and trying and working on. They're tinkering with mind control and brainwashing, and they're using fucking drugs and shit. They're operating, doing these psychological operations and stuff. And like, correct me if I'm wrong. Now, I may have missed it at some point, but like, this book is just kind of almost a precursor. This is like before the fucking internet came along, folks. Like, this is like, I can only imagine sort of what these people, how they have harnessed the power of that to fuck with society.
Internet was like a part of this. I mean, see, this is the other thing about Lansdale that like absolutely blew my mind. But he was actually involved in some of the early aspects of the ARPANET via his boy in ARPA. That, by the way, for those of you unfamiliar, this was what DARPA was referred to back in this era. They added the defense, was it Advanced Research Projects Agency or something like that later. But anyway, so ARPA was originally established in the late 1950s, essentially to help the United States with the space race, to develop rockets and stuff like that. And they lost out on that pretty early to NASA. So for a brief time period, there was a lot of uncertainty as to what exactly they should be doing with ARPA. And going into the Vietnam era, it was basically decided that it would be used to develop technological means to wage counterinsurgency. And this was a big part of why they developed the ARPANET. So the reason that we're usually given for this is that they wanted a communication system that could be used in the event that, there was a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union and communications were incapacitated and so forth. And that was part of the reason. But the other reason had to do with Lansdale's approach to counterinsurgency. He had his guy, William Goodell, working in ARPA. Goodell oversaw ARPA's counterinsurgency section, and he reported directly to General Edward Lansdale. He did not report to anybody in ARPA's hierarchy, but to Lansdale, who at the time was, in this era, 1960s, would have been the head of what would now we think of as the Special Operations Command. And what they were trying to do was to build upon this whole notion of model hamlets that we had kind of adopted from the British. So anyway, this was basically a policy where you were going to resettle people into these strategic hamlets across Vietnam. And in doing this, they were asking the villagers to do all of these censuses and so forth so that they could start compiling data on them. And this is where the whole thing with the ARPANET became tied into this, because they started to envision using computers as a means of harvesting all this data and making predictions on where the insurgency was going, what villagers could potentially become insurgents, what was the prospect of the entire area falling into the hands of the Viet Cong and all this other stuff. And that led to more and more research along these lines. One of them was Project Camelot, which involved us acquiring as much data as we possibly could on all of the various militaries that we were theoretically allied with, so that we could start doing predictive models for how the United States military would fare against them if we were ever in a direct war, what the probability would be of these countries falling into the communist bloc, how effective communist insurgents would be against the military in these circumstances, and so forth. And this ended up becoming a major component of what the ARPANET was designed for, which was effectively to apply methods of behavioral science to it so that they could accurately predict human behavior on both a personal level and on a societal level as a whole, so that we could make future predictions about this, where insurgencies would break out both domestically and internationally. And this was, again, a big part of what Lansdale had been advocating. He had embraced data mining going all the way back to the Philippines, even before they had developed the sort of computers that were necessary for this. But this is sort of another thing about, in general, counterinsurgency efforts that a lot of people are not aware of. But there's such an emphasis on data mining. This was also something that concurrently the British were obsessed with as well, as were the French. But it became part of this ongoing process to establish a crystal ball, more or less, where we could try to predict human behavior on both a personal level and where societies would be doing. And now we're just starting to really see the fruits of all of this in the 21st century. But again, this stuff has such an old origin that we're so unaware of. I mean, when you look at something like Cambridge Analytica, for instance.
Right, yeah.
Micro-targeting voters. So this actually was done initially by a company called Simulmatics, who people tied to Lansdale had connections with. And Simulmatics did this for the 1960 presidential election of John F. Kennedy. So we've been micro-targeting voters. This technology has existed for over 50 years before it gained notoriety with Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah, yeah.
And this all traces back to the stuff that was being done during this period of the early 1960s. So, you know, there has just been some shocking developments with how all of this has gone in the preceding decades.
Yeah, it's spooky. Like I said, the book, yeah, like you're saying too, they've been doing this data mining. They've been using this information way longer, because I think people kind of just weirdly, after the Cambridge Analytica stuff and sort of the social media, kind of people woke up to this or realized it's like, oh, they're kind of like micro targeting people and shit. And it's like, actually, that's been going on a lot longer than you think. It's just they have a much easier way of definitely getting to you because you're all over social media kind of thing.
Well, I mean, it's even more disturbing when you look at, you know, a company like Palantir, the connections to Peter Thiel. I mean, again, some of the technology that Palantir got came out of the, you know, Echelon, the total information awareness stuff that John Poindexter was trying to set up during the early days of the 9/11, you know, with the war on terror and whatnot, when he was, I think at the time he was actually working still with DARPA. Poindexter ended up becoming a lobbyist briefly for Palantir, pushing this stuff. So again, I mean, as everybody kind of knows, the big figure behind Palantir has been Peter Thiel, who was also one of the major early backers of Facebook.
Right.
So just kind of think about that for a minute. You know, you go out, you create a social media platform that is going to generate insane amounts of personal data that can be mined, while simultaneously you're running a defense contractor that specializes in this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's troublesome for sure. Now, you mentioned the book kind of, and I don't like want to give away in a sense, sort of like where the research ultimately heads, but like what, talk a little bit about the QAnon stuff, because you said the book started with you trying to get to sort of get into QAnon, and then it unraveled almost into this sea of sort of counterintelligence and psychological warfare and all the stuff that's covered like in the first book, and obviously it's going to be covered in future books. But I mean, what sort of piqued your interest just about the QAnon in the first place that made you go, okay, I want to pursue this crazy fucking digital cult, if you will.
Well, the stuff with QAnon, as I started to, you know, sort of peel the layers back, if you will, looking into it, it became more and more evident to me that a lot of the narratives around QAnon that have been put out by the legacy media are false, in the sense that they're trying to link a lot of this back to, say, like the Christian right or something like that, which really is just not where the origins of this lie. And in fact, the more I looked into it, it became evident to me that it was really an outgrowth of the psychological operations that have been run in ufology for years.
Yeah.
And not to really give too much of this away, but you can really draw direct parallels with Serpo, with the players involved behind that going into QAnon, especially when you look at like MUFON, which is sort of a major bridge with a lot of this. And again, this ties into all this stuff with Bigelow, and just a lot of the things with Skinwalker Ranch and all this other kind of stuff. But the big thing that you have to take away from all of this is that Serpo effectively used the structure of an alternate reality game. And this was in keeping with how the mythos of ufology had been going for years up to that point, really related to the aviary, where more and more they're creating effectively this false mythos, beginning with Benowitz. You get into like stuff like Dulce and the deep underground bases and all this other stuff. And then continuing into Serpo, I mean, it's basically a full-blown gamification of this. And this was a structure that was adapted with QAnon, because QAnon, again, it's an alternate reality game. I mean, that's one of the things that people don't realize about that, and it's so crucial to it. And alternate reality games, you know, again, brief kind of crash course of this, sort of the first proto version of it was Ong's Hat, which was launched in the late 1980s, but really sort of peaked during the 90s. You had sort of some other precursors to it in various works of art. You could look at, say, the novel The House of Leaves, or the first Blair Witch movie, which sort of played in with some of the strategies of ARGs. But they really got going during the early noughts with the one that was attached to AI, and then also amusingly too, the other one was the Majestic ARG, which was based on the aviary, ironically, probably one of the reasons why they found the alternate reality format so appealing after a fashion. And the reason why this was so important and why the intelligence services started to full on investigate this sort of approach going into around 2008 or so is because it gets people out into the street actually doing things. And that's so crucial when you're trying to change somebody's behavior. Because it's one thing to have somebody passively sitting around reading something online or watching a documentary or something like that. But when you go out and you actually are doing this stuff in the real world, it's a totally different thing.
Yeah.
And you can go look at some of the documentaries that have been made on games like Jejun Institute, for instance, or the, was it Axiom? Gosh, I can't remember the name of it now, the other one that Jeff Hull did. But, you know, this really does generate an almost cultish feel to it. So even just looking at this kind of stuff, you could see the potential of actually turning this into a full-blown cult was tremendous.
Yeah.
And that's really what's happened with QAnon and using these methods.
Yeah, for sure. It's like I said, it's kind of like, it's, I guess what confuses me from what you're saying, though, is like, where's the game part of the, where's the game element to this? What, maybe I'm missing something here.
Well, it's like the whole mystery to this, but it's like, okay, so Q comes on, he gives you his enigmatic drops that are sort of in the Socratic method. And what this is really intended to do is to get people going out and researching that. I mean, when you look at the early QAnon phenomenon, I mean, all of these people are investing.
Right. So it's almost like less a game and more of like lore building. You know? a sense.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I suppose the game isn't necessarily the best description, but on top of that, right, though, typically, I mean, obviously there's a debate as to whether or not people should be aware of it's a game or not, but in the classic construction of an alternate reality game, you're not supposed to be aware that you're playing
a game. Okay.
It's only the, you know, the game master that knows that it's a game.
Right.
And again, this is sort of building on, like, Ong's Hat, because Ong's Hat used a lot of conspiracy tropes that were big in the late 80s, early 90s. I mean, again, a lot of people don't realize this, but the Montauk mythos, for instance, that almost all came out of Ong's Hat. And you can sort of see how that, you know, affected people, where they're going out trying to do all this research on these topics related to Montauk and finding the different justifications for the theories. So that was, you know, again, another early use, not just of the alternate reality game format, but also of conspiracy theories and how that they could be applied to all of this.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the cicada thing.
Yeah, well, cicada, I mean, yeah, that's another major bridgeway into Q, because, again, Q was very closely connected to the later incarnations of cicada as well.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, because I've talked about, I've kind of beaten this drum on the show, in a sense, many times before. It's interesting, because the book, it's The Secret History of Psywarp and Spiritainment and the Shattering of Reality. The last part is kind of what stood out to me, because I've sort of decried this on the program many times, where it's like social media and the internet in general has really done a number on our shared reality. It's like there really isn't – we're having a hard time all kind of agreeing on anything anymore. And it's like – I think it's because everyone's can filter their influences, and therefore they can bubble out all the stuff they don't want to hear. And so it, in a sense, the reality we knew growing up has been kind of shattered.
Well, absolutely. I mean, consensus reality as we know it is gone. And that, I think, is one of the most traumatic things that people are currently dealing with in the nation, because there is no more consensus. I mean, really, you know, especially when you're just encountering people in your day-to-day life, you almost have to go through this process of determining what reality is that they're existing in. You know,
yes.
I mean, it's really blatant for me here, because I live in West Virginia, right at the border with Virginia, outside of the D.C. area. So, like, when I'm in West Virginia, it's like, okay, this guy is probably living in the MAGA reality. So I need to keep that in mind when I interact with him. And then when I cross the border into Virginia, it's like, okay, now I'm in the Biden reality. So I have to remind myself of that. So.
Yeah, it's really weird. It's like, it's really strange. Now, what do you make of the contemporary UFO scene? Because it's changed quite a bit, and it's kind of a little bit parallel to the QAnon stuff, and it's certainly been energized by the powers that be for some reason that we don't necessarily know yet. We can't quite fathom yet, but there's something happening here. There's something going on. Given the breadth of knowledge, man, I really am blown away by you, Stephen, because you can keep all this shit and compartmentalize it and have it all like, you know, like a filing cabinet in your mind. And I'm just kind of sitting here listening to this, and I'm just like, holy shit, this guy, you know, I'm blown away. So, you know, in light of that tremendous wealth of knowledge of the shenanigans that have gone on in the past, what do you think's going on now with the UFOs, or the UAPs, if you will?
Yeah, whatever we're calling them in this day and age, right? Well, I mean, there's a couple of factors with this. I mean, obviously, with the rise of Cold War 2.0, you can again see why the UFO question is being brought out, because it's, you know, it's another convenient way, I think, for covering up some of the advanced weaponry that we're toying with and this kind of thing. But I also get the sense that there's something deeper at work this time around. And it kind of goes back to what I was talking about at the beginning. Because if you noticed, it's not just the fact that the UFO stuff has really started to become a major talking point again, but you're also starting to see a lot more attention being paid to the theories that have been put forth by people like Jacques Vallée or John Keel, more of this, you know, interdimensional or like ultra-terrestrial perception of the UFO phenomena.
Yeah.
And I almost can't help but wonder if this is being used as a stepping stone for discoveries that we've made in regards to quantum physics, to quantum computing, and things like that. Because really, I mean, going back to the Westphalian Peace of the 17th century, from that, what emerged was really this scientific worldview that has been preeminent among Western elites ever since. This very secular, materialistic perception of reality. Everything has a scientific explanation to it, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And there's been more and more pushback with that, really going back to the latter point of the Cold War, with a lot of the more esoteric, let us just say, interpretations of quantum physics and so forth. And this has gained more and more traction as time has gone forth. And again, I can't help but wonder if the UFO thing has been singled out as a kind of stepping stone or bridgeway to this new kind of thinking that I believe we're trying to introduce into the West. I guess a kind of a re-enchantment of the West, if you will. Because quantum physics, some of the really incredible interpretations of it, I mean, it does open itself up to kind of magical thinking or a magical reality, if you will. And I almost get the sense that this is what ufology is being used for now, to sort of introduce people to these more incredible interpretations that you could be surrounded by, say, a kind of non-human intelligence every day of your life, that we exist concurrent with it, with a lot of other incredible possibilities. Maybe, I mean, it's some kind of archetype or something like that. I don't know if anybody really knows for certain, but I do get the sense that with materialism really breaking down right now, it's inevitable that we're moving towards a new paradigm of perception, the way that we experience the world. And combined, I think, with, say, like the growing desire for direct religious experiences in the West, a lot of this other kind of stuff, I think that ufology is being seen as a convenient way of really introducing people to a different reality, if you will, which, I mean, ironically is something that we are badly in need of, as the old one is breaking down right now. So,
yeah,
you know, I think that that's a major role that it's playing now.
That's a fascinating observation, because I've decried sort of the so-called disclosure movement. I'm like, well, look, I don't necessarily think like these are per se like aliens coming here in ships. And it's like, how's the government going to tell people what you just said, which is like that we exist and there's other things that exist alongside us, but by virtue of some kind of scientific laws or whatever, like we perceive them in a different way or whatever. I mean, I don't fucking know how it works. But that's the kind of the thing. It's like, how are they gonna fucking explain this to people who can barely deal with a pandemic or whatever? So it is interesting that you say that, because it sort of suggesting that maybe they hope to do that, and they're using UFOs as sort of a vehicle, maybe just to open people's minds up to what really might be going on, and it's not fucking aliens.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think that, you know, you've already seen hints at this for years. I mean, you could look maybe going back to a film like 2001, A Space Odyssey, where you already kind of see hints of this. But I do think that increasingly, you know, we're moving more and more towards, I guess you could say, the spiritualization, if you will, of the UFO phenomenon.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's now starting to become openly linked to things like psychedelics and this kind of stuff, which, again, just, you know, brings us all back to the question of consciousness and the role that it plays in this. Because I just think that that's one thing that seems undeniable with the body of research that's come out about these, you know, I mean, I suppose you could say not even just necessarily UFOs, but any kind of sort of paranormal or supernatural experiences. But there is something tied into how human consciousness interacts with it.
Yes.
I mean, that gets into, you know, again, Skinwalker, for instance. It's been rumored for some time now that part of what they were trying to do with Skinwalker was to observe the EEG patterns, the brain waves of people who were having these paranormal experiences there, kind of leading into this notion that there's possibly a neurostate that you can induce in somebody where they will have paranormal experiences.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, this is sort of another question as well. I mean, is there something physically that happens within our bodies that brings about these states? But there's a lot of stuff like that that has started to emerge in recent years to where, you know, you just can't continue to try to explain this stuff as it's, you know, a nuts and bolts spaceship that's come from, again, Zeta Reticulum or something like that. And more to the point that, I mean, a lot of these other just peculiar experiences that people are having, like Bigfoot and things like that, that they're probably, that they probably are related to the phenomenon in some capacity. And ultimately, this is deeply tied into, as human beings, how we perceive and experience the world.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how this unfolds in a sense, because they're really pushing the UFO thing now. It's like oftentimes I'm like, how much further can they push this thing? They keep like we're getting closer and closer to this alien part. And it's like I don't know. They're not going to tell us about the aliens, so but they're going to tell us there are aliens. But who knows? You know, you never know. It's very very weird. Now you cover in your research, I guess, all kinds of stuff. Predictive programming. Talk a little bit about this. Would you call that a theory? What would you call that what would you call predictive programming? Just sort of an I guess it's a theory, right?
Well, do you mean like do you mean like in the sense of like what people allege with ideals implanted like in film and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Well, I become more and more wary of that. I mean, I do think that that happens at times, but, you know, again, this sort of goes back to the whole, the question of consciousness, if you really will, because this is something that I've been talking with Robert W. Sullivan a lot about this recently. He's written a couple of books, Cinema Symbolism, I think books 1 through 4 or something. He's got like another one coming out. But, you know, again, it's just something when we look at this where, you know, you can go back through all the films or what have you and try to point to these references to, say, like 9/11 or something like that. And there are a considerable body of them. But again, it just sort of begs the question, is there actually, you know, some kind of government official who's going into the writer's room at these different studios and whispering, hey, you know.
Yeah, right. That part's hard to believe. But the idea that it's in the ether or in the consciousness somehow and that it gets into the art.
Like what, I mean, and that's something that, you know, Rob and I have been talking about. I mean, is it something like almost a childhood's end type scenario where there are events that are so traumatic that they reverberate into the past somehow? And that is something that artists are picking up on when, say, that they're interacting with the muses and how this stuff ends up in a lot of entertainment. And again, I mean, as incredible as that may sound, I have, you know, become more and more inclined to that kind of thinking when you look at certain deep events. I mean, just, you know, for example, like the Kennedy assassination. When you consider just how many freaking people that it's come out like were in Dallas on the day of that assassination.
Yeah.
And it just sort of becomes the question like, well, yeah, they were all part of this cabal. And it's like, okay, they're going to assassinate the president. And it's like they're practically handing out tickets to like every person that they can find to go there to Dallas to see it. It's just like, no. This is not how you direct an assassination.
Yeah,
and then you just have this other just weird stuff like the presence of Buharic's, you know, the 9 entities lurking in the background of it, which makes me think that there is something to these events that fundamentally affects the fabric of reality because they are so traumatic, because they do pretend so much geopolitical upheavals, social upheavals, and so on and so forth. Bizarrely, the John Carpenter movie, Prince of Darkness, actually had an interesting plot line with that recently physics has sort of indicated might be possible. But if you've never seen it before, one of the plot points of it is these transmissions that are supposedly coming from the future that this group of scientists, these quantum physicists, are receiving, and supposedly they're from like the year 1999 or something, that's warning that the Antichrist is coming and that the world as they know it is going to end. The movie takes place in like 87 or something. But it turns out that they're getting these transmissions via tachyon particles, I think. And recently it's come out that there actually does seem to be some evidence that these could go back in time the way that the movie was presenting.
Oh, wow.
So this is just, again, another one of these things where, you know, you've got to wonder, is this something where a CIA spook is going to John Carpenter and telling him to put this in his low-budget horror film? Is this more believable than Carpenter maybe, while interacting with the muses, just somehow stumbled upon this concept that, you know, we're actually seeing now may have a basis in reality? I tend to think that the latter actually makes more sense, I mean, based on the direction that we're going in here. So, again, I just think that this goes back fundamentally to how consciousness affects the world around us. And I think that it's especially evident when you do look at the arts and you can see how it just seems like there is this ability to channel things that are going to happen in future events into different mediums of expression when you are, again, in that sort of altered state of consciousness. Because I do think that for a lot of people, when they're writing, when they're writing music, when they're acting, I mean, it is very much akin to going into an altered state of consciousness. I mean, in the case of the Japanese No Theater, for instance, I mean, they literally believe that the actors are being possessed by the spirits that they're portraying in these dramas when they're going through them. Yeah. So, I mean, this is something that has a lot of theoretical basis in non-Western cultures, has for centuries, that you are effectively channeling something when you're engaged in artistic expression. So I think that that is a possibility that we really need to start considering more and more.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, it's far, as crazy as it may sound, it's actually far more plausible to me, believable, that that's what's going on, rather than, like you said, that some government guy is coming in and he's like the Lone Gunman movie or whatever, or show, where it's like, look, you got to do the thing and it's going to be about this. And the planes are, you know, like how it predicts 9/11. It's like, well, you know, maybe that's not the case. Because like, to me, it seems kind of counterproductive, kind of like you were saying about there's no way to plan an assassination. It's like, if you're gonna have some terrorists, so you don't need to like seed it in a really low rated TV show like nobody's gonna see it all, you know. I don't necessarily buy sort of the revelation of method. I mean, I do kind of, but at the same time, it's like, I think people take that a little bit to the extreme.
Well, the more I've even, like, thought about this, it's like, what exactly are you trying to, like, I don't know, acclimate the public to, that there would be terror attacks? I mean, they've been talking about that since at least, you know, like, the late 70s or something, when you the first, you know, wave of terrorism. I mean, now, like, you know, you're trying to see these arguments that any kind of reference to, like, an outbreak of a virus or something like that is predictive programming of COVID, and it's just like, come on now. I mean, apocalypse being driven by some kind of plague or something, I mean, that's a very old fictional trope. I mean, you could probably go back to, say, the Black Death, and, you know, to point to works from there on out that have used something like that. I mean, come on.
Right, yeah. And it's like, anyone who's been around for a while, especially leading up to the pandemic, it was like, there were several pre-pandemic, like, things that it was like, okay, H1N1 and SARS and Ebola, and it was like, that's why when the COVID came along, for those of us who were kind of up on the news or whatever, it was hard to at least take it seriously at the very beginning, because it's like, all right, is this going to be another one of those, like, swine flu things that turns out that it's not actually, you know, it has any chance of killing me, like bird flu or whatever? And then it's like, oh, no, this one's real, actually.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it definitely gets into some strange stuff with that. But I mean, like, Utopia would be like another show with that, where, again, there's just so much insanity baked into where all of that had come out. I mean, I think it seems clear that at least it was partly inspired by Jack Kirby. Of course, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with Jack Kirby,
yes,
but he was one of the really famous figures to come out of Marvel. And again, I mean, when you go back and look at Kirby's work, there definitely is this element that he did foresee the future. This is something that Chris Knowles, for instance, has written a lot about over the years. Obviously, he's one of the best.
It's uncanny, really.
Oh, absolutely. But again, I mean, Chris is even arguing, you know, it's just, it's really ridiculous to think that Kirby was being read in to put this sort of stuff into comic books, especially since during his, you know, kind of heyday, I mean, comics were not taken seriously. I mean, people who frequently worked in the comic industry wouldn't even tell their neighbors that they worked in the comic industry because they were embarrassed by it. Since, you know, again, it's just like, okay, we're going to take Kirby and have him start doing the predictive modeling of these, you know, national security secrets, which is amusing because then that's exactly what Utopia, they kind of took that tract when they did the series, the original British one, that it was deliberately put in there by somebody who had been read in. And then ironically, Utopia then is held up as an instance of predictive programming with actually not even as much the COVID outbreak as the vaccines afterwards.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is like, again, another one of these things where it's just such a strange set of circumstances that led to the creation of the show, where they're effectively trying to push this notion that Kirby was part of this predictive modeling that the characters that they're developing there. And then the show itself later ends up almost eerily paralleling what had happened with the COVID vaccines. So again, it's just, is this a case where this is being done with psychological warfare efforts, or is it more because they had started to meddle around with possibly whatever Kirby was getting his inspiration with? Is that what it resulted in, what we ultimately got with the series Utopia?
Yeah, it's interesting. It is very interesting. And yeah, it's kind of like, yeah, it's, we don't necessarily need the help of the government to conjure up crazy ideas in a way. So it's an interesting thought experiment in a way. Now, one of the, I follow along on the farm quite a bit, but I don't have a chance to listen as much as I'd like because I'm fucking busy. But you returned to one topic that interests me quite a bit, Catalina Island. I actually spent a few days out there sort of vacationing a few years ago, and I was like really kind of surprised that it's come up quite a bit on your podcast as sort of a, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, sort of like a mystical place, if you will, or certainly a place of intrigue.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of surprised that it keeps coming up so much, but I'm always baffled when I keep finding more and more weird stuff that had unfolded there. I mean, I had originally been interested in Catalina Island because of a group based out of there called the Tuna Club of Avalon, which was the inspiration for the Albacore Club in Chinatown. That's the group that John Huston's character Noah Cross is a part of, and there's sort of this network that is behind the water wars, essentially, you know, diverting the waters that was going into L.A. You know, obviously, this is all based on what had happened with the real William Mulholland and what have you in Los Angeles. And I became really fascinated with this group. I started looking into the history of the Tuna Club of Avalon, saw that there were a lot of figures that played crucial roles in the development of Hollywood tied into it. I mean, you had people like Charles Chaplin, Max Sennett, I believe Cecil B. DeMille, a lot of like the big staples of kind of the silent era of Hollywood, along with a lot of early moneyed interests in the Southern California area. So that was kind of my initial fascination with it. And then just sort of inadvertently, I had started to stumble onto a lot of the high weirdness surrounding it, which I had really no idea of. But as I had found out, there was a pre-Kenneth Arnold sort of UFO sighting that had happened there going back, I think, into like 42, 43 or something like that.
Wow.
And then from that point onward, there had been a lot of reports of UFOs and so forth. But it got even weirder. One of the accounts that I had read that had come from fairly reputable people on the island was just this mysterious door, this green door that would appear in the middle of nowhere.
Really?
So, and then I had found out that, what's his name, Townsend Brown had been a resident of Catalina Island, I think, for the last 20 years of his life. And for those of you unaware, this is one of the guys who was suspected of being involved in the Philadelphia experiment. And in fact, it was widely believed that it was his scientific methods that had led to the notorious Philadelphia experiment. Whether or not the Philadelphia experiment actually happened or not is a matter of debate, but it's just really interesting that of all the places in the world, this guy ends up going to Catalina Island for the last 20 years of his life.
Yeah.
There's also a lot of spooky history related to the island. Of course, the OSS did a lot of training there back in the day, and then later, you had the naval base, I think, on the Santa Clemente Island, which is right next to it, which is a very classified facility. You have people like Marilyn Monroe, who had ended up living on Catalina Island during the 40s. Natalie Wood ended up drowning off the coast of the Catalina Islands in 1983. So it's just been this endless, like, legacy of weirdness, strange deaths, paranormal experiences. I mean, just really the whole nine yards tied to Catalina Island. So I'm still trying to figure out what exactly it is about this place. I mean, even going into just, you know, recent events from the past year, do you remember the Titan that imploded when it was going down? So the guy who did that, Stockton Rush, his original business of these underwater explorations was actually based in Catalina Island. That was like what he was doing, taking tourists down for excursions under the seas there before he started doing the tours to the Titanic. So it's just this weird thing where it seems like it turns up time and again in a lot of this research that I've been doing. And I never really set out to find Catalina Island, but it's just, you know, for instance, like recently I was doing kind of a deep dive into the background of Joseph P. Kennedy and whether or not he was actually involved in bootlegging. So going into the research with this, I'm looking into his time in L.A. and boom, what do I find out? Well, reputedly his bootleg liquor was being brought into L.A. via Catalina Island. It was like a major hub in his trafficking network. So, again, it's just like, of course, Catalina Island. It would have to have a connection to the Kennedys, right?
Yeah, it's a weird place. I assume you've been out there, right?
No, unfortunately.
Oh, wow.
I'm going out to L.A. again, though, in April, so I'm hoping I can maybe work it out where I can go out there for a day or something. I've heard, too, like, they don't have any cars or anything on the island, right?
They have very few cars, but I think that I'm trying to remember now. Like, you can rent golf carts. It might be
That's what I was told. It's like the golf carts and stuff.
I would liken it. Now, I haven't been to Cuba, of course, but I kind of got that sort of vibe in a sense when I was down there. It had a very sort of like you were going back in time almost. It had a mystical feeling to it. Like, it felt like you were going back to like the 1950s or something. It was very strangely isolated. And what I found interesting too, in a sense, talk about predictive programming, it's not quite like that, but it's like it. I don't know if it still is. It may be, but it was like a buffalo sanctuary there. So there's like buffalo on the fucking island. And to me, that like pings into this, like, the show Lost and the polar bears and shit. It was like, because there's this just out-of-place buffalo hanging around on Catalina Island.
That, like, goes back to, because they actually used to film a lot of movies out there on Catalina Island. I mean, it was sort of, like, almost the proto-Hollywood, if you will. And that's one of the reasons why they have these, like a lot of strange animals like that on the island, because so they would do like the coast and stuff if they were trying to film, you know, sort of like jungle adventure movies, like The Most Dangerous Game or something out there, or if they were doing kind of like an Earl Flynn, like pirate swashbuckling thing. But they would actually go into the interior of the island to film westerns. And that's why they ended up bringing, like, buffalo and stuff like that out there.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to, like, make it look like the Old West or something. So, yeah, you do end up with that sort of, like, weird dichotomy where you have, like, a lot of these animal species that were brought there that are not indigenous to the islands and so forth. And, oh, gosh, I would be remiss, too, not mentioning that it's also reputedly a place where they found giant skeletons. I've had several people tell me there that they felt pretty confident that there actually had been 8-foot skeletons found there. But the indigenous peoples of Catalina had actually regarded it as a pretty significant holy site. There was supposedly, I mean, an almost like Stonehenge-like megalithic structure in the interior of the island. Of course, it had disappeared after colonization. It really started, but I think there were reports of something like that around the 18th century. So it just had this really weird history, even going back prior to the European colonists showing up there from a lot of the indigenous peoples and continuing on to this day. So it's just another one of those, you know, places where it's almost like this can't be real. You know, it's just
weird. For real. Yeah. Like I said, it's like a, it has a really mystical element to it. That's, you know, before I went out there, I thought it was just sort of like a sort of tourist type of thing, you know. We're going to go up to Catalina Island for a couple of days. So I'm like, all right. But then when I got there, I was like, there's something weird about this place. Like, this is like I said, it feels like you've gone back in time. It's very interesting.
And then, of course, it sort of inserted itself in the recent UFO stuff, too, because I think it was the Tic Tac video, if I'm not mistaken, which was filmed off Catalina Island as well.
Yeah, there's a connection there, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, a lot of, like, the really high-profile UFO reports, too, that we've seen recently from the Navy, I mean, also have sort of a basis around Catalina Island. Of course, Dave Altman also just did that documentary. What was it? It's not Fire in the Sky. Sorry, Dave, I can't remember off the top of my head. But they did all the research there, like, on Catalina Island, too, and just, so, yeah.
Yeah, it keeps popping up.
Yeah, it's just really an odd place. I mean, I never even heard of Catalina Island until, like, about 2 years ago when I was watching Chinatown. I was like, I wonder if this Albacore Club has a basis in reality. One of those careful what you questions you ask, I guess, kind of scenarios. Now it's like, oh, I see, it's Catalina Island.
You got to go there. You'll like it. It's pretty awesome. I think you will especially like it because you seem more in tune with sort of the occulty mysticalness. You know, I'm kind of like, I'm just kind of like living the life of Riley here. But I feel like you would really tune into whatever the fuck's going on that island.
Trust me, it's definitely on the bucket list. I'm really hoping I can make it out there. I'm going to see if I maybe drag like Robert Guffey out there with me or something like that. That would be a lot of fun. So, yeah, Recluse and the author of Camellio go to Catalina Island. I mean, that almost could be like a movie pitch in and of itself.
Yeah, it would be fun. That would be a lot of fun. Now, at the risk of sort of like dating ourselves in a sense, because like someday this part will be probably like maybe we won't know what we're talking about, but it's what do you think of the whole AI thing that's been going on now? It's an interesting, you can't escape it in a way, and you know, it seems like it's becoming more and more part of our lives. We talked about earlier the shattering of reality. It's like this is gonna, you know, turn the whatever pieces of shattered reality exist now into like fine dust as it sort of makes its way through the consciousness of the population. But I mean, what do you make of all this that's been going on?
Well, I mean, obviously there's the question of just how accurate some of the reports are about AI. I mean, this is something that I've always been kind of going back and forth with, whether it's being hyped up or not. So that's something to keep in mind. But I'm more concerned in a lot of ways with the prospect of like the deep fake technology, because I suspect that we've already seen that being used operationally on us in the past. And I certainly would think going forward, but I mean, that's really where I think that you're, you know, basically taking the last vestiges of consensus reality and tossing it into the wind or something, because now we're getting into a world where, you know, you can actually project almost anything with CGI. I mean, have anybody say anything or something. And this is one of the things where, you know, last summer I was really fascinated by the developments with the whole Wagner situation with Prokhorov and what have you. And which is sort of the murkiness of the guy's character in the first place. I mean, he's this cook who basically rose to become the head of like one of the largest private military companies.
Yeah.
I mean, it almost begs you the question to begin with. I mean, was this guy almost like a character or something like that, that the Russian security services had devised? And then going forward, you still have these ongoing rumblings of like whether or not he was actually killed in the plane crash. The ongoing debate is the, you know, was this a coup? Was it not a coup? Was it being directed by Putin covertly? Was it being directed by NATO and so forth? And I almost think that that is a preview of what we're getting into now, where we're going to see these events unfolding, such as the alleged Wagner coup. And yeah, we're almost going to have no idea about, like, what is actually happening here. Is there even a coup going on in the first place? Is it more severe than what we're being led on? Is it less severe? Is the person guiding it dead? Is he alive? Did he ever exist in the first place, for that matter? I mean, it's a scary situation. And when you factor in AI, where, I mean, conceivably you could have some kind of intelligence like this using deepfake technology towards its own means or something like that, it begs even further question of, you know, how much will events going forward even be driven by human beings? Already this is concerning when you listen to a lot of the theories, at least, that are being put forward with AI in terms of military uses, where we could potentially have battles going forward that are being totally directed by an artificial intelligence without even much intervention from human commanders or something to that extent. So, yeah, I mean, it's terrifying in a lot of levels, but I think that the big thing is going to be deepfake technology, especially going forward here with the 2024 elections and a lot of the developments afterwards, because I mean, already with just, for instance, how the Ukraine conflict played out with the Spirit of Kiev and stuff like that, that was revealed to be a psychological operation. I just think that you're only going to see more extreme versions of this going forward. And with the advances that they made in technology, I mean, the possibility of this is almost endless to what could be done with this. So, you know, it's just, it's a totally different situation where, it's almost like the whole, I mean, it kind of reminds me, I guess, in the sense of like the conspiracy theories that came out after Sandy Hook, right? Where everybody was like a crisis actor suddenly. Anytime you're on that street, no, it's a crisis actor. They're all crisis actors. But now it's just like almost legitimately, I mean, you do have to wonder with this, because you do have the ability to create these sort of instances almost wholly with deepfake technology, possibly with AI directing it. And yeah, I mean, it's now led stuff that previously you could almost dismiss as being ludicrous to being something that has to be seriously considered. I mean, you really can't believe what you're seeing with your own eyes anymore. And that's just horrifying.
Yeah. Well, 2 points to make on that. One, you kind of saw that earlier this year with that Miami aliens thing, too, where it was like, oh, there was the mall thing. And there, you know, it's like it all of a sudden TikTok was like flooded with these crazy videos, and a lot of them were fake, and it was like people like, oh, this is the alien or whatever. And it's like, all right, what the fuck, man? Like, I can't believe anything anymore. Not like I really believe much anyway that popped up online, but it's like now I have to be extra discerning on this stuff, because these things catch on and then spread like wildfire. Should I lost the other point I was going to make, but that's kind of the thing. We just don't know necessarily, like you were saying, you can't believe what's, I know. The other point was, you know, there was all this talking, you mentioned it in a sense with Lansdale way at the beginning. And it's this idea that like, oh, they're going to put Jesus over Cuba and mess with the Cubans and everything. And it's like, you hear these ideas like Project Bluebeam, the thing that's like, oh, they're going to fake an alien invasion or whatever. And you hear these stories, these ideas, at least I did all these years, and it's like, that sounds so fucking stupid. Like, there's no, like, a hologram, like, everyone kind of can figure out a fucking hologram. Like, people aren't going to be fooled by a shitty looking hologram. And now, with this AI and everything, it's like, okay, they could plausibly like fake an alien invasion somehow. Like if this is what we're seeing that's available to us, then fuck, maybe they could like make Jesus appear over America. And I would fucking be like, I'm pretty sure that might be Jesus. Like, I think that ain't no hologram kind of thing. So, I mean, who knows? We are reaching the point where, yeah, it's hard to believe what you see with your own eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this is like why the Wagner thing was so interesting to me, because that really sort of shows how you could hypothetically stage a fake UFO landing or something, or an invasion or something like that. Because, again, it's a situation where it's just like, okay, it does seem like the people were killed, but it was not an especially high body count. I mean, you could probably, you know, just randomly have some special operators go through, maybe use some advanced weaponry or something like that. You know, you splice this in with some footage that's been altered with deepfake technology. You know, I mean, the possibilities of this are endless. But yeah, I mean, it's now, we're at the state where if the Russian government can create this situation where we're not even sure if a coup attempt actually happened within the country, surely, you know, I mean, we're not that far from being able to actually stage at least a semi-convincing UFO invasion, which, again, is just a, I mean, as incredible as it sounds, we're increasingly getting to the point where the technology is making it possible.
Yeah, yeah, that's the wild part. And I guess what makes me, I just wonder if there's like a fucking end game to this. Like, what they, the proverbial powers that be or whatever, they've shattered fucking reality. Do they have some kind of plan to put reality back together in their vision, do you think? Or is it like, or have they kind of been like, oh shit, we really fucked up, we broke reality?
I don't even know if it necessarily enters into that. I just think that at this point in time, there, I mean, that's like really, I think, one of the biggest issues is there is no vision with the elites, at least in the West, any longer. I mean, it's really just become a kind of, I don't know, grab bag, every man for himself kind of scenario right now, where we're just keep throwing stuff at the wall and see what sticks. I mean, you know, I know that that's something that's seen as being sort of implausible by a lot of people, but, you know, one of the events that I like going to are these victims of communism rallies that they have in D.C. I think it's the third week of every July or something like that, that the Victims for Communism Memorial Foundation puts on. It's the Captive Nations Week thing. I was at the ones in 2022, 2023. The 2022 one was actually where they had Madam Zelensky come in before she went to meet with Joe Biden. It was really interesting. They had like the sort of big Secret Service guys come in like beforehand and like warn us, you know, not to get up or your seat or you're going to regret it for the rest of your life type of thing. But yeah, you get into like the 2023 one. I mean, the whole thing they're talking about is narrative management and counter narratives. I mean, they're, you know, again, this is a bunch of people from like the Heritage Foundation, the Atlantic Council and what have you. And they're basically sitting here talking about how they're going to manage narratives and stories and the importance of stories and psychological warfare and all this other kind of stuff. And in the midst of it, I mean, they're talking about the Wagner coup and they have no idea what actually went on in there. I mean, again, I'm probably about the only person in this room that's not, you know, a member of like, or a former member of the CIA or something like that. And these people at least seem to have no idea with what's going on, but they're still going ahead with pushing their own narratives and counter narratives and all this other sort of stuff. And it just gets to the point where you're looking at these people and you're just like, they're insane. They don't even begin to grasp what they're advocating here, the damage that they're already doing and how they're only further exasperating the situation. So I just think that it's just become such an echo chamber to the point where they're not even understanding how the public is perceiving them or how things are concerning to the public. I mean, it was like, I think in the 2022, they're literally having speakers up there mocking the American public because they're concerned about the price of gas, because these people can't even grasp how the average voter is seeing their disposable income eroded through the rise of oil prices.
Yeah.
And then it's just like a joke to them or something.
Right.
Like that. So it's just, there's such a break with reality already amongst the ruling elites to the point that I just can't fathom that there is any kind of end game with all of this. It's just a continuation of trying to consolidate power really for the sake of power. I mean, with the older generations of elites, I at least think that there was some kind of vision with what they were trying to carry out. I mean, as oppressive or Dracorian as it might have been.
Yeah.
In some ways, I mean, I think that that was even preferable to what we're getting into now, where essentially you're seeing this sort of mass chaos breaking out. I mean, the fracturing of the post-World War II structure that's held geopolitics together since that point in time. And ultimately, I just don't think that you are seeing any kind of end game. I mean, when you just look at the situation, you know, for instance, with Israel and Palestine, you have so many people trying to advocate that this was a false flag. And to me, it's just like, well, what exactly was the objective of that? Netanyahu is going to be probably driven out of office and prosecuted for war crimes, if not crimes against humanity. The United States has taken a major beating across the world in terms of prestige. It's destroying Biden's domestic support. It's leading to shipping lanes, the Red Sea, being severely disrupted by the Houthis. To say nothing of some of the ecological disasters that are breaking out from having oil tankers sunk and so forth out there. It's, what exactly would be the purpose of this if it was a false flag?
Right.
There was no purpose to it, or they totally misread the tea leaves, so to speak, as to like what was going to happen. So if this is indicative of what is driving the overreaching objectives of the ruling classes, you really need to be afraid.
Right, exactly. And plus, sort of as you were talking, and I was laying out that question in a way, it's like, well, look, if reality's shattered for everybody, that also means it's kind of shattered for the ruling class elite as well. So it's like, they're not all on the same page either. So it's like, oh, shit, man, we're all just kind of like I said, it is kind of like a runaway train in a way.
Yeah, and I mean, you end up with stuff like the, you know, this whole thing with Aaron Bushnell that had just unfolded here in the Capitol back on February 25th here, where you've got the guy engaged in self-immolation and what have
you.
Again, this is just another thing where there's just so much with this where you have to, like, wonder, well, okay, the guy, he essentially grew up in a sort of quasi-Christian cult that somehow he ends up in Air Force and the intelligence sector. He's apparently making these claims that Hamas, or that the United States have been sending troops into the Hamas tunnels already in Israel to assist them with this. And he's live streaming his self-immolation as it's playing out, which is just insane. I mean, I know you're familiar with Lauren Coleman's stuff on the copycat effect, but Lauren had written a lot about this, with self-immolation being embraced in suicide clusters and stuff because of the copycat effect. So this is something, with the way it's going viral, it's even being set up to where you could see a rash of self-immolations breaking out in protest about this. And in the past, I would have almost wondered if this was some kind of intelligence operation or something like that. But I mean, now with the way things are going, it's even deeper than that, where you almost are wondering, I mean, how much of this was actually happening? I mean, I feel pretty confident in saying that this did, in fact, happen, because I know the area in D.C. where it happened and this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But still, it's just with the way that social media is playing in with all this, with all this other stuff that's breaking out, you know, you could see how just instances like this are potentially going to become quite commonplace going forward.
Yeah. You raise an interesting point there about the copycat effect and how widespread this guy's thing. And it's like, you saw that with the school shooters too. Like, they started live streaming their shit. It's like, then it just encourages more of this stuff. So it's like, oh shit.
Yeah. That's really been the horrifying thing with social media, because I mean, Lauren Coleman has done a lot of great stuff to collaborate the copycat effect. And I mean, now with the way that this stuff can be done with live streaming, and then just, you know, with a lot of these servers like Discord and stuff, the way this stuff is being used to push just really a lot of sociopathical behavior and so forth. I mean, it's a very unnerving situation, to put it mildly. And yeah, I mean, this is another thing where I really worry, honestly, I mean, about the effects that this stuff is having, especially on like Generation Z and so forth, because I feel like people like you and I at least have a little bit more of a grounding, because we grew up prior to social media. You know, we kind of remember like a time before the internet was so pervasive in everybody's lives. But I mean, for so many of the younger generation, I mean, all of this is just normalcy. And that's really unsettling, to put it mildly.
Yeah, it's going to be a really weird world. How old are you, if you don't mind me asking, Stephen?
I am 41, sir.
Okay, I'm 45. So, yeah, it's going to be, as we get older, you can see it now. I don't know. You on TikTok? Like, shit comes to me through TikTok, and I'm like, I don't even, and there are just people that just spend their lives on that. It's like, oh, no, and this is so much misinformation and just bad ideas that circulate on that thing. It's fucking like, oh man, we don't need more shit polluting the reality that we're barely holding on to as it is.
Well, I mean, it's almost just become a sort of induced type of trauma, I think, for like the younger generation.
Yes.
This is like, for me, what's insane about this. I mean, can you just imagine growing up in a world where, you know, you're on Discord or TikTok or something? I mean, you're being sent, you know, videos of child pornography, of people torturing their pets and killing them, of this guy like setting himself on fire and what have you, or just the experiences people have had in some of these chat groups and stuff where kids have been induced into committing suicide while lying.
Yeah, there's some really fucked up shit. Yeah, I read an article the other day about that. There's like, oh God, there's like just bad, just people, really fucking bad people out there on the internet.
You know, it reminds me, like, you know, when you and I were like growing up and we heard all the rumors about how, like, this, you know, there's this underground network of like smut films or something like that that were passed around. And it's just like, my God, this is basically like normalcy now for kids growing up. I mean, they're routinely being subjected to this stuff, murders, or tortures, of these videos and stuff that have been filmed of it, man. So,
it's
not
good. Yeah. What this is a dark way to wrap down the show.
Yeah, I apologize about that, folks. I really do. But
do you cling to? Is there anything you cling to that makes you hopeful? Is there anything that sort of you're like, all right, look, maybe, you know, I think we're all fundamentally decent people. Maybe we can somehow weather this storm. But I don't quite know. I don't know how the fuck we can get out of this broken reality situation.
Well, I mean, there is a lot of stuff, I mean, obviously, that is unsettling going forward. But, I mean, I also feel like fundamentally as well, there is an opportunity to build something out of the current world that we're living in that could become something that's truly positive and beneficial. I mean, I do think that with the breakdown of social structures that are unfolding right now, and, you know, let's not kid ourselves, this really is as significant of a time as, you know, again, going back to the Westphalian Peace of the 17th century, which is where the modern nation state emerged from. I mean, now the nation state is breaking down. Yeah. And we don't have anything yet to replace it with, which I think is, again, a major part of the unsettledness, the tension that everybody's feeling now, because we know that the old way of doing things isn't working anymore and we need a new way to do them, but we don't know what that's going to be.
Yeah.
But in the best case scenario, I think that with the advances in technology, it's created a situation where you can now build communities in real life with people with like-minded goals, with like-minded interests. And I think that we're starting to see that more and more, where people are building together, coming together to build these sort of new communities that are capable of being connected on an international level through the internet, through social media. But getting to the important part, which is starting to have real life interactions again.
Right,
and I think that this is something that's, you know, again, it's only becoming now in the early stages of it, but it just seems like more and more a lot of us who are involved in these online communities, you know, we're starting to take steps to where we're bringing it into the real world, but we're trying to get people together and do things to turn these things into actual living, breathing communities.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that really opens up a lot of possibilities there. I remember I was having a conversation with Alex Sakaris sort of along these lines about, a couple of months ago. But he was making the point that, you know, he doesn't really care about getting to know his neighbors because they don't have anything in common. Yeah, that's really true. I mean, in the past, community by what was local was really important to us. But, you know, going back to, you know, sort of the end of feudalism, well, we all lived within 15 miles of each other. So we would have had really close cultural understandings of everything because everybody lived in the same area. That's not really the case anymore with the rise of internet, with mobility and all this other stuff. And I think that that's had such a devastating impact on society at large because there is no more shared interest to bind communities together the way there would have been in the past.
Yeah.
But now we're sort of seeing a way out of that to where you can create these online communities with people where finally, you know, you have people that you can discuss all of these weird interests with that you would have never been able to talk to with people in your day-to-day lives before. Yeah. And the next step, now that you've started to find everybody, that we've all started to locate one another, is actually getting out into the real world and seeing how that this can be done to where we're not just maybe having meetups at conferences or something like that, to where it's starting to become more of a new way of living.
Yeah. And
that does offer a lot of exciting possibilities. I mean, now, in a sense, we have the, you know, the ability to build the most idealized communities that humans could have ever imagined before. Communities,
right,
that are totally based upon whatever strange interests or spiritual pursuits or whatever that you want to engage in. Major question is, you know, can we navigate through this time that we're currently living in now as the old power structures break down and prevent them from essentially destroying the world? Because I think,
yeah,
that's really the biggest issue with the elites now, because they can recognize that it's a new paradigm setting in and that most likely the way that they've been running things is not going to survive. So, you know, again, it's sort of the psychopath's dilemma. You know, they would rather essentially see the world burn then give it over to something better to come forth or out of it. So
yeah,
it's a difficult position to be in, but I tend to think that ultimately sociopaths and psychopaths, they do not build structures that can survive and that they will eventually weather down here. And in the remnants of Western civilization, the other civilizations across the world, there is the possibility to build something that will be truly beneficial to almost everyone, except, I mean, probably the old ruling class, but who gives a, you know, shit about them anyway, right?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, it's maybe
that's,
not...
It's, yeah.
I mean, it's maybe a bit of an optimistic perception on my part, but I do think that fundamentally going forward, that's really the key. We have to rebuild communities, and I think that we have the means to do so, because that's, you know, that's what, I mean, really gives life meaning. You see all these deaths of despair and so forth that are currently gripping the United States from opioids, from suicides, from alcohol abuse, et cetera, et cetera. I just think a lot of that stems ultimately from a lack of community, from a lack of sense of being somewhere.
Yeah.
And that's the next step, is to give people a sense of being, a sense of community, and a sense of belonging. And again, I think that we have the tools to do that. It's just that we need to reach the emotional and spiritual maturity to do that.
Right, right. And as you were saying, speculating on before, maybe that involves this sort of opening up of consciousness. You know, maybe we need to, maybe more people have to kind of come to that realization somehow. You know, maybe that's part of it. It connects to all that.
Yeah.
Well, what's next for you now? This is I think I fucked up the title. It's The Art Book One. As I said earlier, there's multiple. There's going to be more future installments of this book. So it's The Art Book One, The Secret History of Cywar Conspiratainment and the Shattering of Reality. So when is book two going to come out? You said you had 200,000 words. Did you already write the whole book? And now you're breaking it and putting it out. Are you still working on the remaining pieces?
I'm still working on it. I've got parts of books two and three in different stages right now. I actually have just about finished up with a book on Stanley Kubrick, which will hopefully be out here in the next couple of months. So, yeah, I'm really excited with that. And then I'm going to start delving into the second book of the arc, probably towards probably towards summer this year. But yeah, I'm doing a presentation actually at the Philosophical Research Society on April 24th in Los Angeles. So for those of you in the LA area, consider checking that out. But it's actually going to be on the Fortean Society and a lot of their influence in ufology and surrealism and stuff like that, which is going to be a bit of a segue into the second book of the arc, because the Fortians are going to be in there quite a bit. So it's kind of my way of getting back into that. So anyway, that's at least the tentative schedule going forward here. At least the Kubrick book will be out probably in the spring, and the second book of the arc will hopefully be out either late this year, probably though more like early next year.
Yeah.
And speaking of PRS and Astrognosis in June, I believe. So yeah, I'll be doing some presentations. We can hope also that there will be a Strange Realities in Nashville.
Fingers crossed, man. Fingers crossed. Let's hope. I'm really hopeful. I think I don't know. You've been part of the fabric of Strange Realities. I was talking to Adam the other day about it, and it's like I felt like it turned a corner last year. I felt like it was like, okay, this thing's got its legs under it now.
It was definitely the biggest showing that I've had since I started going there. I've been to every one except the first one, and yeah, I mean, gosh, they must have had close to 100 people, I think, at a few points during the presentations this year. So
yeah.
It's really started to gain traction, and I definitely hope that they'll be able to do one this year, because it really seems like it's starting to get its legs underneath it now, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so that's what's next for you. And where can people find we were kind of laughing about it earlier, the farm. Just they can just put it in the farm, Steven Snyder, or the farm on their podcast.
Yeah, usually the farm podcast Mach 2 is usually the best way to Google it, and that'll come up. Also, too, I'm the longtime curator of the Visup blog, which is VISUPVIEW, Visupview, all one word, .blogspot.com. I don't really update that very much anymore, but there's a wealth of material in there. I did the blog religiously for over a decade or something. There's a lot of, really, there's probably several books worth of material up there for free. So anybody who's interested, I advise you to check that out. And then you can find my books at Amazon. So there you go.
Well, Stephen, man, I can't thank you enough. This was I was nervous about this conversation because you know your shit like backwards and forwards. And you really, as I said, you've got like this filing cabinet in your mind of all kinds of stuff and connections. And I'm like, I don't know if I can keep up with. I hope I can keep up and hold my own in this conversation. But I loved it. I have so much fun. You really make me think. And you really have an interesting perspective on things that I share with you in a lot of ways about the consciousness and the strangeness of all this and the shattering of reality. It's all right in my wheelhouse of where I've been thinking for a very long time. So I really, really enjoyed this conversation and really enjoyed the book. I hope folks go out and check it out, and they should listen to The Farm. And I just can't thank you enough, man. I really enjoyed it. I'm so glad that you and I finally got the chance to chat. It's shocking that we kept crossing paths for all these years, physically even in Nashville, and never had the chance to sit down and talk. So it's been really enjoyable, man. I really, really had a good time tonight, and I hope we can do it again in the future.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, thank you very much for having me on, sir. It's definitely been a lot of fun on my end as well. And yeah, I mean, it's just been great. It's really been something. I mean, for me, that's also been sort of the most fulfilling thing about getting to do all these like kind of cons and stuff recently, getting to meet guys like you and Adam Go Rightly. And, because again, I was, it was kind of funny. I was just going back looking at some of Chris's stuff on the Secret Star Trek things, you know, that he had posted in the Secret Sun. And I saw one of the interviews he had up, I think on like Leslie Stevens or something like that, was actually one you had done on Banal of America back like in 2012 or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It just it kind of cracks me up. I'll see stuff like that now, and it's like, oh man, I actually know Tim, man. That's nuts.
Yeah, man. Now you're part of the catalog. Now you're part of the great chain of guests here from the show. So it's great to have you in the BOA family, man. And hopefully, yeah, we'll definitely. Well, I can't say definitely. That's Adam's call. We'll hopefully cross paths in Nashville later on in the fall. And until then, man, thank you again. And keep on rocking, brother.
Well, thank you very much, sir, and you have a wonderful time yourself.